Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring the stories that make the incredible world of tech and venture tick. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to the founders, investors, and ecosystem operators trying to make a dent in the future. Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I'm super excited to have with me Samira Ann Kasim. Samira is co-founder and partner at Pink Salt Ventures, a pre-seed fund backing female founders. Prior to setting up Pink Salt, Samira was a brand strategy consultant, founded a solar tech venture, and led the strategy and implementation of Taco Bell's digital channel. Samira, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you here with us.
Thanks for having me. Excited to chat.
No problem at all. Let's jump straight into it. So Saloni Bojwani joined you as co-founder at Pink Salt just at the back end of 2021. I absolutely love a good co-founder story. So I'd really like to understand what yours was.
So we met through Alma Angels in 2019 at one of their first events, and we became buddies. And it's funny, I'm a really spiritual, deeply spiritual person. And that day I'd gone to this event and thought, maybe I'll meet my business partner today. But, you know, we didn't actually become business partners then. She approached me last year in around April and asked whether I was looking for a co-founder for the next part of my journey. We'd done deals together. We broke into Hampstead Heath together, which was really during the second lockdown, which was hilarious. And, you know, we both really liked each other as people, but we also had been in co-founder relationships before that didn't work out or where we weren't aligned. So we also approached it very soberly and really mapped out our different working styles in a very in-depth workshop. You know, we mapped out our life values, what kind of fund we wanted to build, our ambitions, as well as working together for around 6 weeks as if the fund was operational. And we also cross-referenced each other. So for listeners, we've got a blog post on that process for anyone who's looking for a co-founder and wants more info and advice on how to go about it. Because I guess the key thing is, while it's a good thing if you get along as people, which we certainly did, you know, a working partnership is obviously a different thing. And, you know, you need to have complementary strengths. The whole needs to be better than the individual parts. And that was really the case for both of us. So we just went ahead and committed to it in around June last year.
Amazing. So, I mean, for our audience, those that don't know, Alma Angels is effectively a network of angels that's focused on investing in female founders. It was co-founded by Dipali Nangia, who's now venture partner at Speed Invest. She's just made partner. There we go. So I'm behind the times already. whilst a lot of emerging managers seem to start off solo, why did you decide to jump into the journey together in a co-founding relationship?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I started Pink Salt Ventures with a single LP, and he's a private equity entrepreneur. And I also had mentorship from a VC partner who works at Mubadala Capital. And the initial plan was always an incubation phase, right? It was always like, learn how to do deals, develop a track record, go out, build your network, actually prove that you can build a fund. And I always knew that I wanted a co-founder and a partner. It was never the case that I always wanted to be a solo GP. It was more that I was in this kind of incubation phase where I was learning the craft of investing from really incredibly talented investors who I'm really grateful to, and, you know, just getting some deals under my belt and doing the work. And the next phase, I'm a collaborator at heart. I've always played team games. I loved team sports. I think your ideas become stronger when you bounce them off someone else, and, you know, they have to be interrogated. So I think the output is always stronger in a partnership too. And when, you know, in my own life, the kind of people that I've been most inspired by, so I have one best friend from university, and her dad is an entrepreneur. He built The Roots, and at the heart of that business is an incredible partnership. And I think with this fund, you know, having been an entrepreneur before where it didn't work out and then starting something on my own where it's like, well, this is going to be the thing that works out. I'm doing this for the next 30 years of my life. If there's a really strong partnership at the heart of it, I think that's a really beautiful thing.
I think that's really interesting. I love the way you talked about it in terms of having always played team games, right? I think having been through the kind of founding journey a couple of times myself in one business, it was very easy to go in as a solo founder because there was lots that I did know and the things that I didn't know I could buy in relatively easily. But in my second business, which is a tech venture in itself, very clearly not having the technology background myself in terms of actually being able to write code and so on, it was absolutely critical to have someone on board, you know, at the level of decision making, of kind of direction of the business, that understood very deeply the software that we were going to be writing. And I think that's, you know, I think it's really important to understand that when you found something, whether it's a business or I guess a VC fund, you are always going to have some gaps in your ability and your understanding. And it is better to find someone who can complement your skill set and, as you said, make the whole better than the sum of its parts than it is to try and kind of half-ass or botch those parts of your skill set that you're not great at, right? Like, so if I'm really crap at writing software, I shouldn't try and write software. I should find someone who is much better at me than at doing that. So one of the things that...
I guess kind of to challenge that, what's interesting about venture, you know, I mean, Saloni and I have different preferred strengths, but to be a really good venture capitalist, I think ultimately you need to be a generalist, and we're both generalists. But we have leanings, right? Whereas within a company, you need someone who is brilliant at tech and sales and marketing, et cetera, and they're very defined and differentiated functions. Whereas, you know, we both love doing deals. We both love telling the story, but there'll be areas of the business that one of us just takes a lead on and then brings the other one into. So it's extremely collaborative. And it's not quite as clear cut as in a company, but we definitely have, you know, our areas that we'll just kind of take ownership on and then bring the other one into, but we both work across everything.
I think that's actually really interesting. I'd like to dip into that a little bit, actually, because I mean, I've considered myself a generalist my entire life. In fact, I even wrote an article about how I specialize in being a generalist. And I do agree. I think for venture capital investors especially, you are looking at such a broad range of opportunities, and even if they are within a certain field or sector, right? Like, so, you know, Pink Salt's thesis is, you know, investing in female-founded businesses within the technology sector, but others may have a thesis of investing in health tech or med tech or maybe in fintech or whatever. But if you think about each of those verticals, even within those verticals, there is such a broad church of kind of opportunities there that if you aren't generalists, you may end up sort of missing, you know, missing the wood for the trees sort of thing, because you get very focused on the outcomes that you have been trained to see rather than the outcomes that you can't see. And I think being a generalist helps at an intellectual level, helps you to abstract away from kind of the problem and look broader than the specific problem. Would you agree with that? Or is that not really the way you look at it?
Yeah, 100%. I think the generalists, they like operating in the bigger picture fundamentally. And it means you can get up to speed relatively quickly in new markets, except where it's extremely technical, but those aren't really the kind of deals that we'd be doing anyway. And we do have a specialism in backing female-led technology companies and women building for women. And we see that play out in a number of verticals that, you know, we also bring our respective strengths to, so like fintech, consumer, health, and the future of work and education. It's really our thesis focus, but within that we are our skill set as entrepreneurs and strategy consultants. Lenny has pretty similar background to me in that regard, is that we are generalists, right? We look at the business model, we look at the strategy, we look at the go-to-market. We kind of approach things from first principles when we're assessing new opportunities with a view on the market and, you know, human behavior and where the world is heading.
Amazing. We're going to talk about that in a little bit more detail in a second. But one of the things that you and I have also talked about is how opaque it is for emerging managers, emerging VCs to set up for the first time. So for anyone looking to set up their own fund, where do you suggest that they start? And what are the kind of pitfalls that they should look out for?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And it's a good dovetail to what I was just talking about in terms of our thesis. When you look at the venture market now, there are a lot of really great generalist funds out there. So I think if you're going to start something, you need to ask yourself the hard question of, is this genuinely differentiated? Am I creating a new proposition in the marketplace for some area of the market that's undercapitalized or some opportunity area that I can see? Because otherwise, it's just going to be really tough, right? If you're just like, I just want to build a big generalist technology venture capital firm, it's like, well, you know, what's your unique angle on that? And I guess that's true for any business, right? If you're operating in a competitive marketplace, then you need a point of differentiation to get out the gates in the first place. Second point, so definitely having a differentiated thesis. And then second point, I think, is, you know, we did VC Lab for those who are out there and thinking about doing their own fund. We found it a really interesting process. It was really great for us in terms of sequencing, like raising for a fund is not the same as raising for a company. There's different steps. Although they share similarities, there are certain things that you need to do. I'm pretty process heavy, intensive workflows, but you want to focus on them at the right time. And if you focus at them at the wrong time, then, you know, you can just get wrapped up and waste your time when really you should be focusing on something else. So that was very useful for us in terms of process. And just kind of also, you know, two founders, we'd worked together on deals before, but just like being really at the coal face. And, you know, in pressure and deadlines, working together, it really like gelled us as a partnership and made us stronger as well. So I think I definitely recommend that program. And also, I think, you know, if you really back yourself and you're onto something, there's going to be a lot of naysayers and there's going to be a lot of people that tell you you can't do it and that it's really impossible and that it's really hard and how hard is fundraising and, you know, just don't listen to them. If you've really got something, just do it.
I think that's advice that most of us should take. And again, we'll talk about it a bit later, but it's definitely, it took me a long time to learn to back myself. And I think that's the one thing that a lot of people struggle with is understanding that they do have the capacity and the capability to do something, to start something. It just takes that first step. I think what a lot of people do is, you know, there's that great saying about overestimating the near term and underestimating the long term. And I think what people tend to do is that they think about the big picture, like, okay, I'm going to raise a 100 million fund, and they start thinking about the 100 million rather than starting with the 500,000 or the 50,000 even, right? Yeah. That first check in, right? Rather than focusing on the whole fund. And I think, you know, it'd be great. And I think you said you're going to be potentially documenting some of the process that you guys went through. I think that would be incredibly valuable for people that are trying to kind of break into venture. Because I know just anecdotally how difficult it is. And certainly, you know, to your point about people, you know, the naysayers saying how difficult it is. I mean, there's people we've talked to on this this podcast who took, you know, 2 or 3 years to raise their first fund. So it takes that tenacity. It takes that kind of real kind of, I guess, at the core of your being, belief that you want to be doing this and you should be doing this to make it happen. So I think that's hugely inspiring. Let's talk a little bit about Pink Salt, right? So only 1.1% of European venture funding went to all women founding teams, according to Dealroom. What are the things that need to change for that to improve?
Very good question. Shifting that statistic really comes down to the venture industry, and it comes down to investors. There are a lot of kind of false assumptions out there. We work very closely with Donna Kahns, who's a professor at London Business School, and she's done a lot of research in this space on what drives the disparity in funding. And a lot of it typically used to be put on female founders. I think even investors aren't aware of their biases. So we've all got to become aware of them, that, you know, women pitch differently, et cetera, but it's just not the case. What happens is that women get asked different questions and they get backed into a corner and they get asked how could this go wrong as opposed to how could this go right? And if you ask any entrepreneur how it can go right, they will paint a more attractive picture of a much more attractive business. If you ask them how it will go wrong, it's automatically less attractive. So that's one thing we can all do as investors and become aware of when we're talking to female founders. I think the other fact is that we just need more angel investors at the earliest stage, because that's what makes a difference. We need more women backing women. We need more men backing women. We just need more people taking that first bet for women to get going. We need more VC partners at the big firms. Women are twice as likely to invest in women. That's proven. I think, you know, Index's statistics were really incredible. I think it was like 50% of the companies that they'd backed were female-led, had at least one female founder. So that's super encouraging. And Sophia Dolph, I saw that she's just been made partner, so that's amazing. Need more of that. And then funds like ours, obviously. Dedicated capital, like that's a tiny, tiny statistic. And I think when it comes to change out in the world, a lot of people think that it's wrong, that, you know, it's some kind of affirmative action and that it's wrong and that it's discriminatory. But let's face it, what's been happening, even though it hasn't been said on the outside of like, okay, we're going to invest in all white male founding teams, that's the reality that's been happening. So that's the subcontext, right? So, okay, I'm going to write it on my door. You're going to attack me for it, but at least I'm putting a line in the sand and I'm making change and I'm addressing that funding gap. But fundamentally, I started this because I wanted to back women building insane businesses, right? And I wanted to make money backing badass female founders. I didn't start it because I was on some kind of moral mission to change the funding statistics. I just wanted to back really cool founders that were building cool businesses for women.
I think that's a really important place to maybe take a slight pause and a bit of reflection, because there's one thing that I've noticed, and maybe this is because I hang out on Twitter too much, but when you are a fund that specifically targets a demographic, whether that's female founders, whether that's black, or whether that's, you know, minority or diverse founders, you can get a lot of heat because you don't, you know, because you won't necessarily, you obviously can't back every single female founder out there, right? Like the venture power law still stands in the sense that you are still looking to back the most ambitious, the most, the businesses and the ventures with the most potential to return the fund. But I think the mere fact that you've kind of put yourself out there as backing a backing female founders or backing diverse founders or whatever it might be, leads to this sort of almost discriminatory, like reverse discriminatory kind of issue where you get a lot of people saying, oh, well, you know, this VC says they back female founders, but actually they didn't take my call or they didn't invest or whatever, which I find upsetting because I think, you know, ultimately, everyone will have, to your point, to your earlier point, everyone has some biases and some, their thesis will lead them to have some biases towards the businesses that they may back, right? And the whole point about investing, I guess, at early stage or certainly in startups is that you have to look at the outliers, right? As opposed to kind of the mainstream businesses. So how do you approach or how do you deal with that? Because it feels like it's problematic because there's an assumption that if you are a female founder, you will get looked at by Pink Salt, let's say for argument's sake, right? Whereas that may not be the case because you still are getting 3,000 decks a year. You're still filtering those down to 300 and then to 10 and then to, you know, and then investing in a small portion.
Yeah. I mean, I just think venture capital funding is brutal in general, right? It's like the percent of people that get funded, no matter who they are, it's a tiny sliver. And there are a lot of people out there who think that they should raise venture capital money because they have cash flow problems. And it's like, mate, you're not building a venture backable business. And I don't think I think there's also people that don't take the time to understand the venture capital business model and the fact that it's based on a power law and, you know, that you need to be backing businesses with insanely huge outcomes for your business to make sense. And so there's a lot of resentment there because people get rejected, right? And, you know, no one likes to get rejected and no one likes to get told that they're not going to build a business of this size. And, you know, many times when people do get rejected, maybe they even could build a business of that size. It's just not thesis aligned. So I just think it's tough in general to get venture funding. And then, you know, the assumption that because you've got a thesis around women building for women, you're therefore just going to back every woman. It's like, well, you didn't read the big print, which is that we're a VC firm. Right. And that we're looking for unicorn founders. We want to back the next generation of self-made female billionaires. That's why we're in business. And that also serves the mission, because when you have female founders with insanely huge exits, they're going to back more women, and women are twice as likely to back women. So it's a virtuous circle. We haven't really been on the receiving end of that heat. Actually, we've received a lot of really positive feedback across industries, actually. I guess it's such a simple thesis that everyone's really excited by it. And we get a lot of support across the industry from people outside of the industry. It's very easy to understand. But maybe the assumption in certain quarters would be that, like, oh, yeah, we'll just back any woman. And it's like, well, you know, you haven't met us then. You don't know what we're about.
Yeah, I think it's really important to understand that. And it's something I talk about a lot, right, which is not all businesses are suitable for venture capital. And, you know, not all businesses, or certainly founders, should not tie their success into their ability to raise venture capital, because ultimately it sets you down a path and a potential outcome or potentially binary outcome, either massive success or massive quote unquote failure, because it's driving you in a certain direction, and that isn't suitable for all businesses. And to your point, not all businesses should be taking venture capital simply because they need to fund their way out of, you know, out of whatever problems they're in. Yeah. And in fact, I think it's a great kind of segue into talking a bit more about Pink Salt's thesis, right? And it'd be great to understand the sort of deals that you look at and what the most important thing it is to be considering at pre-seed, right? Because clearly there's not much traction, right? So where are you focused? Because, okay, obviously you have to tick one box to get into Pink Salt. One is, you know, that first box is a female founding team. what's next? What are the other things that you guys focus on? Is it the actual entire team? Is it the tech? Is it the market? Or is it something else altogether?
So there needs to be at least one female founder. We back mixed teams too. And then where we focus on, so how we look at it is market making female-led technology companies. And how we cut that market making is, you know, it's either a company attacking an outdated industry with an innovative solution, or it's a company building a completely new offering off the back of technology that wouldn't have been available, say, 10 years ago, 5 years ago. Like genomic sequencing is a great example of that. Or it's a company that's building a new market at the back of certain consumer behaviors. The menopause category would be a good example of that. So that's a way to frame the thing that all good VCs should be looking for, which is outlier potential companies. And, you know, when it comes to the ideas that we look at, I guess the first port of call is an idea, is it capable of doing that? That's check one. Okay, cool, I'm going to meet this founder. You're interacting with them. What's their style like? Are they, you know, are they personable? Can they sell? That's just so key at the earliest stage, is like, can you sell your vision? And, you know, you're just fundamentally selling all the time. And then you're vetting the founder, and the traction is different, right? So while we have that broader thesis statement, where we're specialized in is women building for women, because that's massively undercapitalized. And we see that play out in fintech, future of work and education, health and consumer. And there, within those categories, there are a lot, there are like, the problems are the same, right? So you see a lot of founders tackling the same problem. The one that captures your attention is the one that's going out to market, building a product, doing something in such a way that they're going to really capitalize on that market inefficiency and achieve escape velocity, because that's the only way that you can really build a venture capital backable business that's able to grow very fast in a short space of time and get to insane top line revenue. And for, you know, it's really on a case by case basis, right? It could be that they've done it before, you know, and they've got a track record that speaks to that. It could be that they have, you know, they just put something really basic out in market and got insane amounts of signups and insane, you know, you've got to show that you can either build it, or you've got traction on what you're building, or that no one else is doing it and it's an obvious white space and you've got complete self-awareness of like who you need to bring in to execute and do a really good job of it. So all of that being said is really about the founder. You know, at the earliest stage, it's just about the founder.
Yeah, I think for almost every single conversation I've had with a lot of investors, it always comes back to, is the founder backable? And you said it earlier, like, can the founder sell? Can they sell the vision? But then can they sell the vision not just to investors, but to employees, to customers, potentially to suppliers, potentially to, you know, the wider market? And if you don't have, I think, that founder, that really intrinsic skill set as a founder, it's very hard to make anything else happen. And I think there are two kind of things there. There's one where you're a founder who has really strong product knowledge and therefore can understand the problem really well, but are really crap at selling that vision. And again, it comes back to that kind of generalist versus specialist thing we talked about earlier. Often I find that founders that have come from outside of the area that they're tackling are often the better ones to tackle that problem, because they aren't dragged down by the inherent biases that have been built up over time. I'm also very biased in that, because I've worked with a lot of like edtech businesses where often I find that teachers make the worst founders of edtech businesses, because they're not trying to change education. They're just trying to deliver education in a slightly different way, as an example, right? So but I completely buy into the fact that ultimately it comes down to the founder. It always does. But flipping that question around a little bit, like, what do you and Saloni bring to the table that should make you the obvious choice for female teams raising at pre-seed?
It's a great question. I think when it comes to Saloni and myself, it's really our style and who we are as people. You know, we're both straight talkers. We're both really honest and upfront people, and we're very relatable. You know, we have a good time. We enjoy ourselves. Like, obviously, we work super hard, but we don't take ourselves too seriously. And we've also been founders ourselves. We can relate to what our founders are going through, and I think that really resonates. And then, of course, we have our specific subject matter expertise. Like, I have a background in consumer. Saloni's done B2B SaaS and marketplaces, so we can bring that to the table. But we also have our investment areas that we've been working in. I've done a lot of health tech deals, so Saloni. So there's the knowledge, but I think what's most differentiated about us is who we are as people, and the fact that, you know, we're going to have the hard chats with you. We're going to be honest with you, but we're also going to support you, and we're going to be there and sit in the shit with you. And, you know, you can call us, right? And it's a very informal relationship. I'm Northern. Northerners are just really nice, friendly people, you know? And Saloni is just awesome and super chill. So I just think our style as people definitely differentiates us, but then also our portfolio strategy and the fact that we're going for a consolidated approach and we're doing high conviction investing at pre-seed, which is probably just about as risky as it comes. But that's because, you know, we actually want to help our portfolio founders, and we want to make sure that they get follow-on rounds. And, like, you know, that funnel is insane, right? To the amount of companies, to the ones that we actually choose to back, there's a lot of qualifying going on in that, and we're taking a strong position because we want to see you do well, so we're going to be in your corner. And I think that's pretty much the opposite of a spray and pray approach, and I think that resonates with founders too. And then, you know, we're women, backing women. We're the first VC fund in the UK backing female founders. We've got first mover advantage. There's obviously a halo effect that comes with that for founders. I think everyone likes to have a pioneer firm at the cap table, but also sadly, there aren't that many female investors. So that's a differentiation point, having women on the cap table. And if your end users are women, having people that understand your customers as well.
Amazing. I think anyone listening that is looking to raise venture and has a business that is suitable should certainly be reaching out to you guys at Pink Salt. I think the reality is, right, as you said, when you are raising venture capital, the firm and the partners in the firm need to be having your back, right, in your corner, because today there is so much capital awash in the system. That may change over the course of the next 12 months, we'll see. But there is so much capital awash in the system that going out to just raise money alone, or as a VC, just having the ability to deploy capital alone is no longer sufficient, right? So founders are looking for partners. They are looking for people that will be on the journey with them over the long term. And I think, you know, if you have the backgrounds that you and Saloni have and have had the experience and can, you know, and can also empathize with that founding journey as female founders and as female VCs, I think that adds a lot of value, because ultimately, you know, I know as a founder, sometimes you just want to be able to send a WhatsApp or pick up the phone and say, look, this is a situation, what the hell should I do? Or, like, it all feels really, really tough right now. Is it going to get better, kind of thing, right? And I think if you have people that understand where you're coming from, that makes life a lot easier. And the problem we have, I think, with a lot of firms today is that there are a lot of finance people, there aren't a lot of founders running VC firms. And that I think leads to, a problem in terms of that differentiation and the value add. So look, just as we round off, this podcast is called Nothing Ventured for a reason. And that's really down to partly to my enthusiasm for backing myself, as I said earlier, and also trying something out regardless of the outcomes, right? So the venture you co-founded back in 2016, which was called Cavin2, I think, was quite short-lived, right? I'd really love to understand the challenges you face and the journey that ultimately led to its shutting down, but obviously the learnings from that, because I think, you know, anyone that's founding a business today, it doesn't matter whether, well, I mean, obviously it would be helpful if it's successful, but the learnings you get out of the failures, I think, are almost as important as the successes.
Yeah, 100%. My first backer, an LP, you know, he always said, don't go to business school, just found a company. And I was like, well, I've already founded a company. And also, you know, the learnings you get, from just founding a company are, that is business school and the school of life. But what you do get from business school is an incredible network. And Saloni went to LBS. So together we've got it covered. So when it comes to Cavin2, I guess, you know, looking back, that was the first instance of me backing a female founder. I'd met Marianne Van Obel through a group of women who were either entrepreneurs or aspiring entrepreneurs. And she's a brilliant, brilliant designer. She was at the RCA, has got pieces in MoMA. And she had this table in the design museums of the year. It was a solar table and it was getting a lot of press, a lot of traction. And she wanted to commercialize it. And so it was myself, Marianne, and Peter, who's the CTO, who's also a very brilliant product designer, a technologist. He was at the IDE RCA course. And at the time, I was obsessed with technology, really wanted to be a founder, specifically within design-led technology hardware. She had this table. They were at the RCA. That's where James Dyson went. I was like, right, this is it. This is going to be the big break. And, you know, the reality was we didn't get the big break. You know, that was, my sister was on Wall Street. She taught me how to do financial modeling. She was like, this is how you do everything. Cause I'd obviously come from a brand and story and strategy culture perspective, but I hadn't, you know, come from a finance perspective. So learned about unit economics and actually what is a scalable business model. And I come from a family of like social activists and medics, you know, they're not business people. So they weren't like telling me what's wrong with this business model. Having years of experience, I just kind of jumped in very green at 26 years old, thinking that it was amazing. And I guess, the big learning is you need to filter for noise and value. And building a business is about value creation. And there are things that are topical and zeitgeisty, and they might get a lot of traction in the media, but media traction has nothing to do with the business model, right? And that, I guess that's big learning, number one. Number two, I joined these two really brilliantly talented people, and they're incredible creatives. I'm the commercial one. Like, together, this is going to be a winning team. But if you want to build a big business, every person needs to be really commercial, or at least be extremely commercially motivated, even if you're not the commercial person, so you can build a commercial culture in the firm. And if you have founders that aren't really interested in those big outcomes, you're not going to focus on that, right? And that's really the point at which I decided to step away from the business. You know, we'd invested everything in this table. I was the one out in the market speaking to our potential customers, interior designers, architects. They talked about the price point being really prohibitive. I was kind of pushing for us to pivot into another product. And, you know, it just wasn't happening at the right kind of speed for me to stay involved anymore. And, you know, years later, you know, Marianne, I would also encourage everyone to take a look at this as well, because she launched a light in the end, which is a more accessible product line. And she did that on Kickstarter, and that's done super, super well. But, you know, fundamentally, she also lives in the world of ideas, right? And she's kind of inspiring people about the possibilities of the future. And she's was better suited to having more of a studio environment where she could collaborate with big businesses and they could do all the heavy lifting, but she could also work with institutions. And she just represented Holland for the Design Expo in Dubai. So that, whereas I was there to build a globally scalable business, and that's, you know, where every, it's, that's all about reality, right? It's not about living in the conceptual realm. It's about taking something that is conceptual and building something big from it. So I think, and that really informs that decision-making process with Saloni. Is like, okay, well, you know, what is ambition to you, right? And what is success to you? What do you actually want to achieve? And how do you really drill down into that at the earliest point, instead of like, oh, well, yeah, I want to be really successful and make loads of money. But it's like, well, no, actually, what kind of organization do you want to build? What kind of, how do you want to spend your time and your focus, right? Time and focus are really the only things that we have, ultimately, especially as entrepreneurs. So yeah, I think just like making sure that you look at the unit economics. And the other thing I'd say about Cavendish is that I think we were a little bit ahead of our time. The technology was still a little bit too expensive to make the product cheaply. But I still really back the idea. Like, who doesn't want to live in a beautiful world that's self-generating sustainable energy, right? That's a beautiful, beautiful vision. And I still back that. And I still totally back my co-founders as well. They're both brilliant, but fundamentally we all wanted different things.
So I think there's so much to unpick there. The first thing is, you know, what you just said, you just closed off by saying is like, fundamentally as founders, you wanted different things. I talk to a lot of founders and I talk a lot with founders about needing to be on the same page as their co-founders, because ultimately, if you're pulling in different directions, and I've seen this happen, and it's caused businesses to implode, or it's caused certainly co-founders to split up, and all the mess that kind of then comes out of that. If you're not pulling in the same direction, you're just going to end up tanking the business in one way or the other. The other thing I think it's really important to pick up on there is, I think there is this need for founders to be very resilient and to be not always on, but, you know, constantly striving, which I think is a really amazing trait for founders to have. But I think there is also a trait that founders sometimes need to bring into their wheelhouse, which is realism, right? Which is, if this isn't going to work, how do I quickly sever the ties and either pivot onto something different within the same business, or how do I pivot away from the business and do something different altogether, right? Because I think what tends to happen is, what I see is, a lot of founders who raise a bit of early seed capital, pre-seed capital maybe, but then kind of struggle to grow beyond that, and they just continue slogging away for years and years and years. And to your point, like, all you have in the world is time and focus, right? So would you not rather be spending your time and focus on something that is really positive or generative? And maybe that is working for someone else, for sure, right? But equally, it could be a different product in a different market altogether. So I think those are really, really incredibly valuable lessons for anyone listening. So Samira, thank you so much for joining me here today. It's been absolutely wonderful speaking to you. For our audience, where's the best place for them to find you? Are you on Twitter, on LinkedIn? Where's the best place for them to look for you online?
We're on LinkedIn. We're on Twitter. We've got a website. Pinksaltventures.com.
Amazing. I understand you're in the process of getting to a first close on the fund. Congratulations. Looking forward to seeing some amazing female founders being backed by you and Saloni. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. Follow us on social and at nothingventure.tech to make sure you never miss another episode. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving us 5 stars on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. We love to hear from our listeners to understand the topics and guests that they'd like to hear about and from most. Drop us a message via the links in the show notes, and thanks again for your support.